Welcome, welcome back. Christ is risen. DDG is also back from the dead. I know that you're sick and tired of hearing me rant and rave without seeing my face on spaces. So we decided to come back to stream for you guys. Really excited to be back here because the world is changing at an alarming rate, and so is DDG. We have a new co-host with us now. You might know him from Spaces. My favorite Turk, my only Turk friend, Murat, born in the Soviet Union. So we have an authentic Soviet with us, aside from Lydia. And well, of course, we have our Yugos. But Murat, thank you so much for sacrificing yourself. I was going to say volunteering, but more like laying yourself on the train tracks and sacrificing yourself for my audience. We are already over 1,300 viewers. That is fire. 1,400 we just hit. That's crazy. Thank you guys so much for joining us, especially on Easter. Murat, how are you? Please tell us all about you, why you decided to jump into the multipolar pool with DDG.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Sarah, and happy Easter to everyone, of course. Some of you guys might know me from Twitter. I know she introduced me as a Turk, to be exact. I'm not. I'm Armenian and Azerbaijani, but that's kind of where I started on Twitter. And I'm just excited to be working with Sarah, who I met last year. And really all I wanted to do on Twitter was just come on and talk Geopol. So this is a lot of fun for me. So I'm looking forward to working with her.
I love the comments, but Turkey sucks anyway. Yeah, and that's true. It's true. And we might get to that today. We'll see. But we're obviously going to start with our favorite, the Ruskies. Happy Easter from the front line. And this is how Ukraine celebrates it, I guess.
Всем привет! Находимся мы на Белгородском направлении. Поздравляем вас с праздником Великой Пасхи. В связи с перемирием, воздействия по противнику с нашей стороны прекратились. Отмечаю, что была попытка прорыва со стороны противника. Наступ был успешно отбит. Противник эвакуировался с белым флагом. Россия вперед! Победа будет за нами!
So obviously, multiple sources stating that the ceasefire was broken by Armed Forces Ukraine. But I kind of want to take an examination of what kind of. Sorry, I'm a little distracted. The puppy is on my left right here. So if you see me kind of looking over, it's me trying to make sure she's not being naughty. But leading up to the ceasefire rejection or breaking of by Ukraine, which way you want to look at it, it doesn't really matter. But leading up to that, the United States is showing some cracks in the relationship with Ukraine. Trump kind of outwardly saying he's kind of annoyed with Zelensky, and Zelensky saying that he's spouting propaganda from the Kremlin, directly from the Kremlin. So we espouse Kremlin propaganda. So I'm glad that Trump's finally on the team. Let's see what this Kremlin propaganda is.
His offer to purchase more Patriot missile
batteries. Oh, I don't know. He's always looking to purchase missiles. You know, he's against. Listen, when you start a war, you got to know that you can win the war, right? You don't start a war against somebody that's 20 times your size and then hope that people give you some missiles. If we didn't give them what we gave, remember, I gave them javelins. That's how they won their first big battle with the tanks that got stuck in the mud.
Kremlin propaganda is don't start a war, you can't win. What do you think about Trump's kind of realist approach to the Ukrainians and Zelensky and kind of Zelensky's reaction to it?
Yeah, I mean, this just sounds like, when you're trying to like discourage someone from doing something and you kind of, the language you use sort of just reflects that and carries that negative sort of tone. I mean, that's just what it sounds like from Trump's end. I mean, Trump, he doesn't really speak subtly. And so like, when he wants like something to, what his intent is when he says something or like what he's trying to convey. And so like here, I mean, it's just fairly clear that like, the U.S. is just all in on kind of on de-escalation, on pulling back, and they're trying to pressure Zelensky at this point. What do you think?
I agree. And we're not going to play the clip because it's pointless, but they did reiterate that. So that came after the Rubio statement. So before Rubio's statement, Witkoff went over to Moscow. That really didn't appear to be very fruitful. Zelensky also stated, I think Witkoff has adopted the Russian strategy. I think that's very dangerous. He is consciously or unconsciously, I don't know, spreading Russian narratives. It's not helping. So everybody is against Zelensky. It's not Zelensky's fault. He's not wrong. It's everybody around him is just gobbling up that Kremlin propaganda. Witkoff is a real estate guy. So interestingly enough that he's kind of sent to the wolf's den, kind of like, what do you think about sending Steve Witkoff to go negotiate with the likes of Putin and Lavrov and just the Russians in general?
Well, it seems like, I mean, Witkoff was probably sent for, you know, a particular, or I should say they selected Witkoff for this, you know, for a reason. But the thing here is that it appears like there's a sort of like peace proposal narrative trap, right? Because they get Zelensky, you know, triggered in a sense. And what the actual outcome of this is just alienation of critical partners. And so on one hand, you have Zelensky kind of doing this this act where he's showing strength and independence. And on the other hand, it just leaves Ukraine in no man's land or on an island where they're just, it's like, okay, like you have, you know, this independent stance, but like, what does that leave you with? Nothing. Sorry, you're muted.
Thank you. I do want to play Witkoff's, what he talks about after his meeting with Putin, which I think kind of lends a little bit of insight. He did say, when you begin to look at those five regions, and he's obviously talking about the Donbas and Odessa, Russia, that you care about them. And by the way, you care about them too, Ukraine. If some of them are more Russian speaking, do you care less about that? Just, I'm not sure what he meant, but we'll see. I guess we can take a look at this interview following the meeting.
I think you used a very good word there, Sean, emerging. I do. This is the third meeting I've had with him. This last meeting lasted close to 5 hours. We had two of his key advisors in the room at the time, Ushakov and Kirill Dmitriev. And it was a compelling meeting. This peace deal is about these so-called five territories, but there's so much more to it. There's security protocols. There's no NATO, NATO, Article 5. I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of detail attached to it. It's a complicated situation from, you know, rooted in, you know, some real problematic things happening between the two countries. And I think we might be on the verge of something that would be very, very important for the world at large.
Now, when Witkoff's talking about it, does he mean, it sounds more like a business or a commercial engagement, doesn't it? It sounds like we got to kind of get ourselves out of it so we could start engaging diplomatically and commercially with Russia. Is that the vibe that you kind of got from it?
Yeah, but like, isn't that the vibe from like Trump's administration as a whole? Like, it always seems like his administration is packed with like these sorts of characters that are kind of, you know, their talents are more in the, I don't know, branding or business and stuff like that. And it was even kind of like when he had Rex Tillerson as his Secretary of State. But yeah, like it definitely does carry across that way.
They do seem to have kind of one foot in, one foot out. And I don't know that I love, I mean, that's part of the art of the deal strategy. Always make it look like you could walk away at any time. That's part of the art of the deal. If you guys want to, I mean, you could go to ChatGPT and just ask it to summarize it for you. You don't really need to read it, but that's one of the tenets of it, is to always kind of make your opponent know that you held the leverage because you're always comfortable walking away. And that's been something that they've started to really allude to. I mean, we've heard from Trump, I think earlier, he said, well, then he won't be in office for too long. That was very early on in his term. He was talking about Zelensky. They've also expressed they're kind of like annoyed with him, or, you know, kind of treating him like a schmuck, if you will, at the White House. And then Rubio comes out. And this is from both Rubio and Trump. But Trump was asked if the U.S. will walk away from Ukraine at the White House.
And so we need to determine very quickly now, and I'm talking about a matter of days, whether or not this is doable in the over the next, you know, few weeks. If it is, we're in. If it's not, then we'll have to, we have other priorities to focus on as well.
If for some reason one of the two parties makes it very difficult, we're just going to say you're foolish, you're fools, you're horrible people, and we're going to just take a pass. But hopefully we won't have to do that. And Marco is right in saying we want to see it end. Think of it. Every day, a lot of people are being killed as we talk about, you know, as they play games. So we're not going to take that. And we'll see. I think we have a good chance of solving the problem, however.
Are you prepared to walk away completely from these efforts and these talks?
Well, I don't want to say that, but we want to see it end.
So interesting. They're both outwardly expressing doubts and a desire to walk away if these talks don't work out. And like we iterated before, is that it was further clarified that Rubio intended to put the pressure on Ukraine and not Russia. What are your thoughts given the rumors that we've heard that Zelensky rejected a ceasefire? We had the video in the very beginning from the front from our special forces stating that it's already been broken. They fired upon them and trying to break through. And then we have these guys saying, well, if things don't work out, then we're going to kind of walk away. Putin offered a 30-hour unilateral ceasefire, especially for the reason that both Easters match up this year, which is highly uncommon. But the both Easters matched up this year. This is, I believe, the third holiday ceasefire, maybe fourth, that Putin has offered and has been rejected. And the Kherson governor came out and actually said Ukraine violated the ceasefire. Now, Ukraine has somewhat said maybe like all the communications didn't get to all the places. It wasn't meant to be like that. But what are your thoughts on this sort of this wishy-washy, but now we're right back in the thick of it anyway. It never really paused.
I really think this whole thing is a smart maneuver for Russia because they get to sit pretty and kind of play with house money. What it looks like from the West is, there's somewhat confusing optics from Washington, and because we are nominally like allied with them, and at the same time we're counter-signaling them. So like on our end, there is this sort of like, it doesn't look great, right? So like it's somewhat fractured. It makes Washington appear fractured. And then from Ukraine's end, it, as we mentioned, it's, you know, they're sort of isolated. So like I feel like I just feel like this is just a smart like chess play by Russia. The way that and I'm sorry, your question right now was in regards to the
just your thoughts. You could go off on a tangent if you want. Go ahead. So I know that you stated before that if Zelensky's signaling strength and independence by rejecting the ceasefire and going right for Witkoff and even Trump, but he's also taking a huge risk at alienating U.S.
Yeah, and the point is to like just try to trap Ukraine in this point where it's like you're offered a deal you don't really want to take, but then at the same time it looks like you're the one prolonging the whole process and everyone around you is just kind of like, we're not going to do anything. So you have to accept it. So like, that's just sort of the cornering that's going on with Ukraine right now. So it's smart strategy and it'll probably, will probably work, you know, at some point, because at this point now it's just holding on.
What do you think about the recent offer from the Trump administration to recognize Crimea?
So I have my own thoughts on Crimea. I just mean in terms of like the long-term sense, but so their offer, I don't even follow that point too much. So they were offering to recognize Crimea on behalf of Russia.
Yes, they would say they would finally recognize, and that would be like a pathway to peace, as if that matters to Russia at this moment.
Yeah, I really do feel like that matters to Russia, like the recognition, because so like if the US recedes in this conflict, the other power brokers are going to be who? It's going to be like China and it's going to be Turkey. I mean, let's be real. And I feel like Russia does not want Turkey's paws anywhere near Crimea. And they know that they want them. So like it is important for Russia to get recognition of Crimea from someone to start there, because they don't want that loose end still hanging. And so like I do think that particular part is important for Russia. So this recognition from the US comes as a win. That's a big win. If we follow through with it.
What about when Rubio kind of, I'm trying to segue into our next segment, because Rubio said we're going to back off because we need to pivot to other priorities. Are we talking China, Middle East? Are we talking, what does he mean? I think for Rubio, we know that he means Latin America, but regardless.
Sure. Yeah. I think that there's all these areas around that, like the US would rather be involved in than this like sinking Ukraine war. You have China, you have this like budding like Israel-Iran thing, you have Latin America. I just think that like Ukraine is like down on the list now for the US as far as their like strategic interests. And so they're just trying to like jump off this ship, really.
Kind of interesting. How do the recent events in the Middle East, specifically the Saudi-Iranian normalization and what comes with that? How does this also affect the United States' position in and on Ukraine?
Yeah, I mean that's a perfect segue to this is not a hot conflict, but a cold conflict, but still a major conflict nonetheless. But Iran and Saudi had met this week, and this is a big shift because, once again, this is part of this broader pattern of U.S. receding from the region, these actors somewhat behaving independently, or, perhaps we might see China's role growing. But essentially, Salman? Yeah, Salman was visited as the acting defense minister, and he... Mm-hmm. This is a big meeting. These are not two countries that meet often. And the versatile thing for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia here is that like they're able to somewhat show a pivot because they're, of course, major U.S. allies, but then they're also having these talks without the U.S. really even present. So they're trying out their own little, one foot in, one foot out thing. What about you? What do you think?
I think the same, because I think that the Syria, everything that happened in the Levant and West Asia actually puts the Saudis and the Iranians on the back foot. The Saudis were also pushed out. I don't think that people talk about that enough, what happened kind of with Gulf Arab influence in the Levant. I mean, we know that Qatar itself paid, I think, over $1 trillion to overthrow Assad in this final like finale. And that pushed out Iran probably for the foreseeable future, and also negatively impacted Saudis, what little influence they have left. They're mostly focused on Europe and the Balkans, and obviously the Middle East and the subcontinent, but not so much the Levant. So I think that this is really interesting. And I think you brought up a good point, is sort of, this is taking, I don't want to say their sovereignty, but this is a move in the right direction for these two to normalize if we're going to continue down the path of multipolarity. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, multipolarity is sort of...
I know you hate it, but you're going to have to learn to like it.
Yeah, well, multipolarity, it's not my jam, but like it's sort of this inevitable equilibrium that'll come when like the present powers recede. When you have one particular power, everyone's used to things going a certain way. You kind of follow that power's ideology, et cetera, their global order. But like once they recede, there's this sort of, a relativism almost, in a sense, where everyone kind of has to, no one is the preeminent power. So everyone kind of has to acknowledge each other's culture and each other's way of doing things as kind of equal. And so that'll be a new world, because right now that's not how we look at the world. We look at, the Western way is the right way, or like the main way we do things, that everyone kind of has to fall in line. And I do think there'll be like a change in some of these either norms or, some of the way we do things internationally, in this, new multipolar landscape. So that's kind of what I'm most interested in, is just seeing, like, you know, we've taken for granted kind of some of these norms that we have, which only have been around, you know, like in this modern era of like this US-led global order. And so, like, when we recede out of this like liberal, you know, Western liberalism as the main defining program, I don't know what exactly that looks like, but that'll be the world we're in.
I also think that, and I want your opinion, is that we have a very moderate, progressive, reformist government in Iran. Progressive relative to Iran, not in our Overton window at all. But a reformist government in Iran, then that's the one obviously conducting the talks with Saudi. Saudi is starting to get, I don't want to say secular, but I don't know what else to call it other than, I don't know. It feels like there's the Islamic facade there, but then there's like Shakira concerts and raves. Is that something that you think do you think Saudi would be able to exert any soft power on Iran in that sense? Because that could be a backdoor for the West. The West could be like, yeah, go ahead and have those talks because we'll just slide right in.
It's really hard to imagine how they would be able to, like, it, like, push out soft power on Iran, because like culturally they don't have that much to offer in a sense of like the usual examples of soft power you think of, right? I don't know. I really feel like Saudi's a weird one because they're so rich, but they're so like behind in a sense of just like their own cultural cachet. So that, like, you know, if they are influencing them in some way, like I wouldn't even know how to picture it. Like, I feel like it'd be easier for a place like Turkey if they wanted to influence Iran, because they actually have like some soft power to export. And with Saudi, I just don't, like, they're just some like rich guys who are just trying out new things.
They're like UAE with even less soft power.
It's like, you know, when a sports owner, like when a team gets a new owner and it's this like guy who comes in and he's like, we're going to win the ring in 5 years and we're going to try all these new things. And it's like, but they've never owned a team before. So they like get the wrong players. And like, this happens all the time. But yeah, that's what Saudi reminds me of. And so like, I don't ever see them as being like a major broker in the way that like Iran or Turkey was for the region. I just feel like they'll be able to sort of be present, but and probably have some behind the scenes influence. But like, I don't know if they'll be able to project in that same sort of gravitas that these other powers do.
I'm wondering though, because now we'll get into the calling off of the Iranian strike. I'm wondering if talks with Saudi and Iran actually help buttress up the decision to not strike Iran with Israel. So for our listeners that don't know, Israel initially posed a plan to strike Iran with the assistance of America and their armed forces. And that was slated to go down in October. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if it was supposed to be like October 7th or something ridiculous, because that's how Jews are, where they love numbers. But anyway, so Israel had originally planned it for October, and then they backed it up and they said, no, we want to do it in May. And I feel like that was actually Bibi trying to see, like, what kind of leverage do I have here? How badly do they really want it? And Trump saying, well, that's not in my timeline. And Trump being Trump, I don't think Trump was too cowardly. I think Trump was basically saying, you're not going to tell me what to do when I'm in the midst of talking. And he gave Iran a timeline till I believe it was May 25th is when their time runs out. So Trump absolutely refused to support the attack, saying that he would choose to pursue negotiations over the nuclear program, which, side note, he tore up the JCPOA, but okay, we're wasting months and months and months renegotiating the JCPOA that he tore up to spite Obama, but I digress. There was a huge internal divide, allegedly, with Tulsi Gabbard, J.D. Vance, Pete Hegseth, Susie Wiles, and even Waltz said that they didn't think it was a good idea to strike Iran, which I thought was interesting. There were obviously Bibi came to the White House on the 7th of April, and that's when the U.S. announced that they would not be joining in on this, whatever they have planned. But we did move a large contingent of warfighting equipment to Diego Garcia right near Iran. And yes, we've used some of it on Yemen, but not anything of the magnitude that we've moved. What are your thoughts on all of this? I kind of just took it as a Trump saying, like, you're not going to tell me when and where I'm going to strike. like and kind of switch up the deal. Because if you remember, on the way to the White House, Zelensky switched up his deal, and that was their excuse for kind of treating him so badly. So we know that they don't like the whole bait and switch thing. That's very, very taboo, and they don't like that. They don't like to think that they don't like people to think they have one up on them. So I thought that that's a lot where it came from. Or do you think that Trump there's something more to it? Or is Iran really a threat to the United States?
Yeah, they clearly are not like a threat to the United States. They're a threat in the sense of like they're on the opposite team and they're a big player, right? So like in that sense, they're like oppositional to us. I don't think they're a real threat. And that this whole like, I was about to ask you too what your thoughts on Iran going nuclear are, or if that'll happen. But like this whole issue with Iran is sort of dizzying because here we are talking about a nuclear deal when we already had one, and the same administration is the one that tore it up, and now they're back like Groundhog Day, and they're just like, oh, we need this thing that we had just already had and then tore it up. And
right.
Of course, like Netanyahu was, you know, an opponent of the previous of the JCPOA, and he, you know, he had let Trump know, and of course that was all, you know, the whole big thing. It was the first time Trump, you know, tore it up. It was just kind of like another indicator of like, you know, Trump's Zionism or like friendliness to it. And so now here we are again. I mean, sometimes I'm just like, I feel like I'm in crazy town trying to follow the story and what like all the twists and turns are. There was a lot of interesting discourse I heard this week in regards to this nuclear issue for Iran, right? Like, I can't believe, why hasn't Iran gotten a bomb yet? Or, you know, I don't get why Iran doesn't get a bomb. Well, I feel like that day like will come. I just don't know. I don't think that it'll be soon. Like I don't think they're going to come into having a nuclear bomb quite yet. I think people get excited when they see that Pakistan has one, and they're just like, why can't Iran have one? we've moved very quickly from the like the paradigm where like only a couple of countries were supposed to have it, and now we're just like, why doesn't everyone have it?
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm hoping we kind of push those days far ahead. Like, I don't want to be in this point where like everyone's armed, but Iran's big enough to where like they'll probably need it. I just don't know like how, I don't know like what the next 10 years, 15 years of our mutual diplomacy looks like for that, like,
environment. That's the thing. And I think that, and I was going to ask you that because we're doing negotiations with Iran to put back into place an agreement that was in place that worked well enough. It didn't need to be torn up. That was something that he did probably for Bibi and to spite Obama, to kind of crap on Obama's legacies. Like, I got you now. And this sends a really bad message to the Russians and the Ukrainians that we're trying to negotiate an agreement with. It's like, here we are, really working our tails off to get another JCPOA that we ruined, but we're back here to negotiate Minsk 3. It's like, why would anybody engage in diplomacy with the United States at this point?
Why would they engage in diplomacy with the United States? Why, like,
well, I mean, other than the fact that they have to, but like, it's
why ever listen to anything this administration says? Because this is the same thing they did with NAFTA when they tore that up and then they reworked a deal, which was just like, it's just with a new name. And that's, you know,
yeah.
But like, so they love to do this where they like tear something apart and then just reissue it and just slap on their own name on it. And it's not too impressive in regards to like when you just watch and you sort of like assess how they do things, but I suppose it's effective in its messaging.
That's after coming out of the talks between Saudi and Iran, the Ayatollah said, our belief is that the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia is beneficial for both countries. And the Iranian Armed Forces chief said, ties between our armed forces have been improving since the Beijing agreement. And they did conduct operations or drills together. Do you know anything about the kind of mesh up or what a mesh up between the Saudi and the Iranian armed forces would look like? It's not very formidable, is it?
No, but like, I was going to say, like, you're the military, I'll leave it to you. I don't know about the mesh up, but like, it does strike me as like, these both have shared interests in their shared vulnerability, which is they both have oil interests, right? Like they have oil infrastructure that they're concerned about, both, you know, Iran and Saudi Arabia. And so like a powerful incentive for cooperation is, of course, a mutual vulnerability. And so like that aspect to Saudi and Iran does sort of point to something that, you know, they both can work together on. But sorry, I'll leave the military mesh up.
I don't know very much about the capabilities of the Saudis, except that they're very much under the thumb of the Americans. Anything that they use, anytime they want to take off, anytime they want to engage their air defense systems, that has to go through the Americans. Those systems are kind of owned and operated as such. They have a few that they can operate on their own. But I mean, I think that if it came down to it and with no other outside involvement, the IRGC would walk through the peninsula like a hot knife through butter. Like it really wouldn't even be a competition.
They don't really have any war-hardened experience really in that regard. They're very green, like just in all aspects of their military. So they might have like, you know, they might be able to afford some good equipment or have like, you know, U.S. help. But like, yeah, they're really not a big player or they're not scaring Iran probably.
And Iran is still in that. Iran is trading oil with China faster than they ever have. That's because obviously because of the tariffs and because their relationship is strengthening. And you, like I said in the quote, they did mention the Beijing talks, which has really strengthened the relationship between Iran. And I think I want to reiterate the fact that Saudi and Iran were both pushed out of the Levant. So this is also an alliance of a loser's alliance of convenience a little bit. So I think I don't want to say losers, but this is to their best. This is in their best interest to engage with one another for sure, because neither one of them want to engage with Turkey, and they can't engage with Israel.
What do you think about Qatar's role? Like, do you think their star is rising still, or do you think
they're maxed out? Very much so. Qatar is taking they're like UAE, but way more politically and militarily savvy. UAE is off to the races with some ridiculous influencers. The Qatar is really examining how to push soft power in certain ways, especially in the United States. They're paying multiple people on Twitter to push. I won't go down the rabbit hole. People think Tucker Carlson is paid by Qatar. I don't know if he is or isn't, but I do know of at least a handful of people that verifiably are funded and pushed by Qatar. And I think that that shows their prowess in that field, but I think that they're going very slowly and being more pragmatic about it. But they are spending money like water, $1 trillion to overthrow Bashar al-Assad. We spent $15 billion, and I think that was way too much. So that's pretty impressive that they're ready to put down that kind of cash to push their sort of priorities. We have to see how their relationship progresses with Turkey. Especially.
Yeah, for sure.
And they're still housing members of Hamas. I'm not really sure. And those talks are still going on. So things are in shift. And that's why now that we're talking out loud about it or thinking out loud about it, that alliance between Saudi and Iran makes a lot of sense. A lot of sense. And I think that if they were actually true to that alliance, it could be something pretty serious. With the money, amount of money and access both of those, or Saudi has, Iran has some money, but the amount of money and access Saudi has and the strength and military buildup that Iran has, that could be pretty, pretty significant.
And as you said, especially if Qatar is, working with Turkey or and continues to, then that does open an avenue for the Iran, which is crazy to imagine, but it opens the door for Iranian and Saudi cooperation to counter that.
Well, somebody would have to, and it would have to be somebody of a massive scale because the liquidity of Qatar is so crazy, and Turkey is obviously very militarily formidable. So it's kind of like a counterpart to both of them. You have a very formidable Iran with a very rich Saudi and a very formidable Turkey with a very rich Qatar. That could shape up to be disastrous, maybe. Probably not, but maybe. These guys seem to be a little bit more pragmatic than we are.
Well, they are actually an example. Like, in contrast to Saudi, I feel like Qatar really punches above its weight in soft power, and it kind of has figured out ways that, you know, to influence its respective region or internationally through, like, you know, through its use of media, through its, you know, funding of influencers and stuff like that. Like, I'm sure Saudi does the same things, but Qatar, for such a small country, does incredibly well.
I agree. I mean, Al Jazeera was in its time and not so much anymore. It was a powerhouse. Al Jazeera has a lot to do with the overthrow of Assad, a lot. And they push very anti-Ansar Allah rhetoric. They're very, very good at, and I think that they learned and garnered a lot from actually their Al Jazeera offices. You wrote some stuff on our notes about the kingdom still hosting U.S. troops and whatnot. So how do you think, don't you think that the normalization talks between Saudi and Iran happening contingently with the talks between U.S. and Iran could pose something serious?
I feel like, so I don't know if it'll reach a point where it's something serious. I think the U.S. is just sort of, going to like pout its lip at this. But I really don't think the U.S. wants to get involved in this particular issue any longer. Outside of keeping an equilibrium, like, I don't know if they're going to throw their weight behind one particular side anymore. I mean, because like, as you see here, let's say you have a Turkey-Qatar alliance and then you have, a growing relation between Saudi and Iran. Which side does the U.S. prefer, right? It's a little difficult there because now you have... So I think U.S. is just interested in not poking this any further. You have China as a broker, showing up. If China really does start to show up there...
Right.
But then I'm rambling here, but like, what I'm getting at is that like, I don't know if the U.S. will have much of a choice really to, to do anything about
I think you're bringing up China is important because China does not like Turkey. So China provides another counterweight to that Qatar-Turkey alliance. China does not like Turkey, and China does not like radical Islam, and they do not like countries that push it. So they would be, that makes sense that they would enter and try to normalize between Saudi and Iran. That's very advantageous for China.
Because the other really like interesting region and the reason why China doesn't like Turkey is because Central Asia is going to be key kind of for what's going on. And in the 19th century, you have the great game, right? Which is between the England and between Russia for Central Asia. You have the, Britain that's coming up from India and they're trying to reach Central Asia, and you have Russia going from the top down and they, converge in the middle. But anyway, you have these two powers that are fighting over Central Asia. And now it's kind of evolving to where you have China and Turkey actually that are competing for this region. One through, just through its size and influence and wealth and population. And then on the other one, you have someone who's trying to utilize like a cultural connection, like pan-Turkism, Islam.
Right.
And China doesn't like that. And so
no.
we go from this north-south pole to an east-west pole. And that's another like little showdown to watch out for, China, Turkey, and this battle for the Central Asia.
That's really, I'm glad you brought that up. I think we need to do at least one episode on Neo-Ottomanism and its effect on the world or how it butts up against China's foreign policy interests, because people don't understand what Neo-Ottomanism is or pan-Turkism, and who better than a Turk like you to teach them about it?
Yeah, or just that, like, the that ideology being so like popular in Turkey, but like solely in Turkey and less so amongst
right.
And that's a lot of the confusion that happens with pan-Turkism, is it's kind of seen as this like equally popular among all Turks, and it's just not. And so I think China knows that. The people in Central Asia certainly know that. And so China will actually, ironically, will probably be an ally in the fight against pan-Turkism. It's going to come to that because, that it'll be in their own interests.
I'm like trying to type these. He's Armenian Azerbaijani. I just call him Turkish because it's funny. Yeah. Okay. I spelled Azerbaijani wrong because I was rushing. But this is, I want to get to our last segment because this is the one I've been ranting and raving about all week long. And people have been calling me thank you for coming, Fine Home Painting, love new subs. Please welcome, guys. And thank you. We're over 5,000 now. That's astonishing. This is like a huge welcome back and I really appreciate it. But we're going to get down, I'm going to channel my inner Candace Owens. We're going to go down my rabbit hole, no pun intended. But I've been ranting about this all week, this Bukele visit to the White House and then kind of the way it took me after that. So, okay. So I want to start with the hot mic moment. And this is what kind of sent me off. So this is a hot mic caught between Donald Trump and Bukele. I'll let you guys watch and kind of decide what you guys think.
Homegrown's are next. The homegrown's built. You got to build about five more places.
Yeah, that's fair.
All right. it's not big enough.
Right. And the reason why I piqued my interest was because, well, what does he mean by homegrown's? I didn't automatically defer to, he means us. I was like, maybe he's talking about the homegrowns in El Salvador because they're notoriously overpopulated in those prisons. They're overburdened. It's the most overburdened prison system in the world. And it's probably one of the worst. But so they're planning on building new ones. So I said, okay, that's interesting. But then another clip came out from none other than Caroline Leavitt to reassure us that we were right.
Deporting American citizens to Central American prisons. Is it legal, or do you need to change the law to do it?
Well, it's another question that the president has raised. It's a legal question that the president is looking into. And he talked about this yesterday when his meeting with President Bukele in the Oval Office. He would only consider this, if legal, for Americans who are the most violent, egregious, repeat offenders of crime who nobody in this room wants living in their communities.
And then there's this CHNB thing. President Biden let more than 530,000 people from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, Venezuela into the U.S. with this CHNB program. He did it with the stroke of a pen. And now a judge will not let President Trump undo it with the stroke of a pen. So are you guys going to give all 530,000 plus people individual deportation hearings, or are you just going to try to deport them?
I spoke to White House counsel's office about this morning, because obviously another rogue district court judge is trying to block the administration's mass deportation efforts with this latest injunction. We will fight this in the court of law, and we will ensure that every individual who was who illegally entered our country and was really taken advantage of by the previous administration because they abused the parole system in this country to fast-track legal status, as they said, for these illegal immigrants, and they completely abused our legal system. Many of these paroled individuals were then given temporary protective status, which the intention of that TPS was only supposed to be used in times of war or storm or destruction in the home countries of these migrants. It was completely abused. These migrants came here for economic reasons, and they illegally entered our country, and the president is not going to tolerate that. And so we will continue to focus on deporting as many individuals as we can.
Interesting. So, and if you were still confused, I have one more for you, just in case you didn't hear it the first two times.
And some are wondering, though, if it's a slippery slope. What's your reaction to President Trump suggesting that homegrown criminals could be sent to El Salvador next, American citizens?
They're criminals. They broke our laws. They need to suffer our punishment. Look, I don't want Donald Trump teaching my daughter's Sunday school class, but dadgum, I like him in the White House because he understands the rule of law, I feel like, and America is sick of this stuff.
But doggone it, I like him because he's...
I had to check how to spell dadgum. I didn't know if it was dangum or dag... It's dagum. I think it's Southern for goddamn it. Anyway, so we have the three officials telling us we're the homegrowns are next. Thankfully for you, Murat, you're not a homegrown. You're not born here, so you'll be safe. I'll be in El Salvador prison with brother Nathaniel on one side, and I guess Auntie G and maybe Chai on another or something. But what really got me was that, okay, well, what are they even talking about? Then we have this sort of deportation of this guy with the MS-13 tattoos to get everybody worked up, right? With a distraction. They're over there fighting about whether a smiley face means S or Satan or it doesn't mean anything, just as long as they're not looking at us. So I started to dig in, because when they're trying to distract you, you should actually dig further into what they're doing. And I started finding out that Eric Prince is proposing huge contracts into El Salvador. He is working alongside Bukele to privatize the prison system in El Salvador under his newly formed cooperation or corporation called USB. So he created a new LLC, which is common. What these people do is they'll create these shell companies. So Blackwater was for Iraq, and then he switched over to academia to go do, or academy to go do UAE stuff. And then he had another company when he was proposing China. Now he does USB for El Salvador. He wants to build a 10,000 ped camp, process 100,000 US detainees. He specified non-citizens first. So that tells me that citizens will be later, I guess. He wants to waive trials and all and ICE standards. And this is the kicker. What they really want to do is to create a treaty of sessions. So for our listeners, a treaty of sessions would mean that once El Salvador signs into this contract, it will be backed by the U.S. government, but he'll be signing it with Blackwater, but he'll be ceding this territory to the U.S. government. And basically wherever these private prisons are, or wherever Blackwater to USB, but Blackwater for all intents and purposes is doing their prison guard work, that would be American soil. So it closes up that legal loophole of deportation, because this is no longer deportation. It's just removal and placed in under custody. It's very scary. If they're already, and they're already building the infrastructure. Google has moved down there to provide cloud services. The IOF is training and outfitting the soldiers, which are nothing more than death squads. So am I being hyperbolic, or am I like overreacting, or is this like, isn't this kind of fishy, especially with Bukele trying to say, we're going to be the Bitcoin haven where everybody can come with their billions of Bitcoins and nobody has to pay wealth taxes. Not that I'm a pro tax person, but it's very interesting that he's catering to the crypto bros. Google runs down there to make a Google cloud headquarters. They're hiring people like crazy. We have Eric Prince trying to enter into contracts. The Israeli private companies have privatized the agricultural and the water sector of El Salvador. We know that Palantir is investing, and we'll get to them next. Isn't this kind of spooky?
Yeah, real quick, I was going to say on that last clip, like, I hate those like Southern phrases with the like, I wouldn't want him teaching my daughter Sunday school. The dog won't
have to. Like, the store is as flat as two sides of a pancake, or whatever they say. I'm hotter than a dog in church. Or like, yeah, I don't even know what that means. Why would a dog be in church?
So the like, there's this like authoritarian creep under cover of like something legal. So essentially, there's no. On one hand, there's no border enforcement in this particular case, right? You just have like a construction of a parallel penal regime that's that targets the certain U.S. citizens that are deemed undesirable, you know, for whatever reason. So it, you know, using foreign soil kind of bypasses it bypasses certain rights that we have here. And so this would be like, if I could invent a word, like a Guantanamification of like U.S. penal system, where you're just like utilizing these offshore sites.
Exactly. That's what I said. I was like, well, they don't have to, they're going to fulfill their promise of closing Gitmo by deporting people to Bitcoin City.
Yeah.
And deporting them indefinitely. I mean, we have kids and U.S. citizens in Gitmo that are their cousins of some terrorists they suspect in Iraq somewhere. And you're like, so it's not far-fetched to say, oh, well, Sarah should probably go to El Salvador in prison since she knows some Russians at the front or something like that. Not that this admin would do that, but I'm just saying. And then you and now I'm going to get a lot of crap. Don't give me any crap tonight in the spaces. You know who you are. But what about the changing of the definition of anti-Semitism and the enforcement of such on the colleges? Now, I'm not saying that, oh, this is a Jewish op or a Jewish plan. I'm just saying that that's a litmus test to see if you guys will put up with that. And then if you're saying, because the general message that I'm hearing from MAGA is not about the citizenship, not about whether they have a right to be here. It's about that they're subverting or going against American foreign policy and creating waves that way. So if that's the reason why they want to deport these visa holders, how far do we have to push them till they're like, well, you're also subverting the U.S. foreign policy. You should probably be detained for a little bit until we can get that under control.
Yeah. And this is all kind of part of this broader, like, post 9/11 thing that the U.S. is shifting into, where it just sort of utilizes these like extreme incarceration methods. And I mean, you're right. Like, the Gitmo has people that are just like in there for whatever. We don't even know. They're not going through due process. And the, as for El Salvador, you know what El Salvador kind of like, what it reminds me of, you know, those like budget car dealerships where they're like, oh, credit check here. It's kind of like, everyone's welcome. Like, if you have bad credit, we'll take you on anyway. Yeah. So that's what El Salvador is like pitching itself as this like place where various regimes can he has a willingness to waive civil protections to make El Salvador just like testing ground for domestic dissidents and stuff.
Yep.
Like that.
He offered testing ground for the IDF, actually. And he offered testing ground for Peter Thiel and his surveillance. And you're right. And the funny thing is that when they came out, do you remember when Michele did like the hype video where they were dressed up like, I don't know, like they looked like the dark elves from Lord of the Rings or something. They looked crazy. And he was in like his dictator outfit. I was like, and he was like, this is so base. And I was like, this is a show. And that's when I was like, this guy is a fraud. And I started looking up all of this stuff. And while Bukele wasn't initially a CIA plant, people have to remember Bukele was ousted from two political parties before he was able to run for president and win. And yes, he did run on a being hard on criminals ticket. He was buttressed up and outfitted, kitted, and trained by the U.S. and Israel afterwards. So he owes them. And people think like this guy came in and by the grace of God that he just transformed El Salvador overnight. And you're like, no, that takes millions of dollars in training and people on the ground. And you know, and this isn't, and I know that in 20 years, we're going to hear about death squads in El Salvador and people disappearing like under Pinochet and Somoza. And I'm just like, are we doing all of this for the sake of, for you to say that the crime's better, or is it so you can have a Bitcoin haven where you kind of have an unending pool of slave labor? And also don't forget the way this idea actually started was Bukele, in order to raise funds, started privatizing the cells inside of the prisons and offering up spots for foreign prisoners where he would charge the country a fee. So that's where this idea started. It's very scary because it's like literally human capital. It's just like Kamala saying, we can't let prisoners out. They put out the fires for free. And it's like, well, we need prisoners because we need Bitcoin slave labor.
Yeah. And now we're like getting at the point where like this is all getting kind of convoluted, because like there are aspects to Bukele that like or that sort of political system, or someone like him to come in and just, you know, shake up a country. Like, I think stuff like that is good. The thing with Bukele has been like, I've never seen any sort of dictator who's regime has been so successfully astroturfed by the internet and like the web, like just like Zoomers on the web who like don't know that much maybe about the country. And I'm not gonna say I know that much about El Salvador, but like there's like all these like Zoomers online who are like, this guy's so based and red pilled, and it's like they know close to nothing, right? Like I'm his hype and his stock is like so high. A whole lot of nothing, right? But
yeah,
we'll see, like, because, you know, there's, you know, all the everything they said about what he did for crime in the country. We'll see how, you know, how true or how correct that was. And if it was, you know, great. But like, as for all this stuff, I've never been a fan of the like the move for Bitcoin for the country. These like ways that he sort of pitches himself as this, I don't know, parking spot for the rest of the world for their shit. Like, yeah, it's
I never really liked Latin American dictators. I like other dictators. I never liked the Latin American ones that much.
And there's a whole archetype of it. Like, they have a long history. Do you think he'll be in power a long time? Like, there's a chance he could. But like, if he's hot air, like, he is a lot of hot air. Like,
yeah, he's a lot of hot air.
Somebody could just take him off.
Well, we could, but that's the thing. I don't think that he matters as much, and he'll just, I think that's the thing. We could take him out at any time, but it's actually really useful to have him there. The Zoomers love him. He's the crypto bro. He's like the crypto savior. He's the first president, first country to use Bitcoin as a currency inside the country. And I tell people in spaces, and I'll reiterate it, These anarcho-capitalists have been looking for a place to park. There are a lot of people who got very rich off of various coins, and I'm not saying that's bad or they're scammers. They got very rich, but they don't want to be told what to do with that money because Bitcoin and all crypto was promised to be an unregulated way to earn, hide, whatever your money. So they want to make sure that they continue to prevent that. And there's been many, many movements and many, there was actually a very long, not a long-standing one, but there was a conference that existed in Mexico called Anarchapulco, and they wanted to build their own commune, kind of small town in Acapulco. And they succeeded for a short time, but it eventually fell apart because Mexico's crime-ridden and they were all white and people got killed. You know how it goes. So now this would give them that that extra layer of safety because you're going to have the El Salvadoran death squads guarding you. You'll have free labor and no taxes. And so this is kind of, it feels like it's a building off of that idea. And I want people to remember that Eric Prince's contracting doesn't just go to El Salvador. He wants access to all of the ICE systems and he wants to privatize ICE functions. So he wants to take over the deportation hearings and then ICE would be focused more on students and domestic stuff, domestic terrorism, i.e. anti-Semitism. So he wants access to all of those databases. And he also incentivized bounty hunters that he said we could do an incentivization program where we pay bounty hunters basically a head fee. We charge by the scalp, we get with scalp rewards, I guess. So that's what they're incentivizing bodyguards or bounty hunters to pick up the people. Then they take the people and they do whatever they want with them. And not to be left out, of course, is Palantir, who was the victim of a leak this week. And honestly, they should be the victim of a leak every week. But this week, they leaked that they are working hand in hand with ICE. They just scored a $95.9 million contract with ICE to help them with surveillance. This will help manage Trump's mass deportation campaign. Palantir has acknowledged that there will be failures in the removal process and is prepping Palantir employees for the potential backlash. The quote is, "We recognize there is a risk of potential harm. Many risks will not be within our means to address." They want to take over all of the logistics, understand the data, understand who's self-deporting, who's not self-deporting. And side note, Palantir and Peter Thiel have invested heavily into El Salvador and Israel for their surveillance systems. I feel very spooked out, like I'm creeped out.
I always say this, that like the thing that'll follow the American system, or, you know, the American century, for a while, America's kind of set the tone for everyone. And even ideologically, you know, this liberal democratic system was it. And so we often talk about how, like, when liberalism dies, what are we going to transition into, or what is this all evolving to? And I always say that, like, this, whatever China's doing is going to be what comes out on top. And the US will eventually settle into something similar. And what I mean by that is this sort of like third position authoritarian system that's like interwoven with tech. And so, you know, because tech allows us to monitor people, allows the state to monitor people in far easier ways than the state ever was able to before, it's going to utilize that. And so what I'm getting at in this long answer is that, like, Palantir, this is the beginning steps for when, like, the, you know, we get into this like dystopian cyberpunk like world where, you know, tech is a major part of our, you know, every minute of our lives, whether it's through super apps or, you know, all these other apps that we've put our entire life on. And then the state is just going to be logged right into it, or just be able to track that, whether it's through companies like this or, you know, other means. But as we, you know, continue moving into this this world where everything is powered by tech or by AI, et cetera, that is just one more, like, one extra lens into our life from the state and its extra control for them. So I don't know if it's going to be Palantir that, like, is the company that, you know, ends up on top when it's all established and sophisticated, but they are getting in on this early. So, and yeah, you are right to be creeped out because
we these are been, been talking about the idea of techno-fascism. I don't know that we would call it that. I keep defaulting to that because it's the best term that I can find right now. But the techno-fascist thing and this extreme consolidation of power. So we just talked about Palantir and we talked about Blackwater. And now then another contract came out this week between SpaceX and Palantir to build Trump's Golden Dome system, which will then be rented out to countries as a missile defense system, privatization of our military, more a privatization of our military functions. So I just feel like there's this handful of these technocrats, this like Elon, Peter Thiel, David Sachs, maybe a few others thrown it up, Eric Prince, and they're just like wielding all of the power. And it's independent of the government. It's actually not, it helps a little bit, but it's not a huge net positive for America in terms of soft power. They're not reaching out as like, I'm American with American money and American government contracts. They're reaching out as private institutions.
Yeah. And this is sort of the life cycle of everything where like when something is rising and it expands under its own sort of banners and institutions, that they're like, once that starts declining, these same institutions or the same brand that like once carried sway, it starts to recede and it's parted out little by little and privatized. And kind of like an old parallel to this in a sense, not that like privatization at that time was happening in the same way, but like when the Roman Empire started crumbling, the way that it got sort of Germanized, or the reason that those German petty kingdoms showed up is because if your military security is crumbling, you need to find new security. And so someone kind of shows up as a free agent or as like a private actor. And that's what the German tribes at that time sort of were. They offered protection and they offered, military might in a way that like the Roman Empire could no longer guarantee. That's how these territories started to go Germanified. And so that's sort of kind of what I think of when I see this like American system being kind of parted out and privatized and just like almost like in a chop shop where it's just being sold off or being carved out to these people interested in profiting off it. But it's bad news for for the American Empire, we'll say that, and for life over here.
So then we'll end the episode on a positive note. Bad news for the American Empire, that's a positive note. And Murat, how do you feel after making it through your first episode of DD Geopolitics live broadcast? It wasn't that hard, was it?
Yeah, I appreciate the kind comments.
They actually, I hate to say this, but they like you more than they liked John.
Oh, okay.
I know.
Well, I appreciate that, guys. I promise this will probably be the worst. That it'll only get better from here.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But
this was the most unprepped and kind of rusty that I'll be. So
I'm rusty, and I've been streaming in the meantime. Thank you, FaZe, and I'm so glad you're here. Happy Easter to you, Murat. Any closing and final thoughts?
Just once again, I'm looking forward to doing this with you guys. And Christos Voskres of Sim for Easter. Have a great rest of your Sunday, guys.
We love John. Everybody in the chat, I miss John too. Maybe we'll reach out to John and see how he is. But thank you so much for coming back to our resurrection episode on Resurrection Sunday. Please visit us at ddgeopolitics.com. We will be back on Thursday with Nick Cruz from RBN. And me and Murat will be back every Sunday, 12 Pacific, noon. Take us out.